Good day. Today is Thursday, 2nd July 2026. And before I proceed with this program, let me remind you to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. Well, over the last couple of days, I've been discussing in my videos the rumors that have been circulating in Ukraine and in the United States about a massive Russian strike on Kiev, which was said to be pending. And indeed, last night, that massive strike did indeed take place. And even by the scale of strikes that we have seen from the Russians, this was indeed a very big one. Apparently, something like around 70 missiles in total were used, which is a big strike by any standards. It's about as big as any missile strike on Ukraine that Russia has ever conducted, though there have been a few strikes in which the Russians did indeed use more missiles in total than the ones that were used last night. But of course, the distinction, the difference, is that in earlier strikes, when we've been talking about hundreds of missiles being used, over 100 missiles, and there have been one or two of those, the targets have been spread out across the whole of Ukraine. Whereas last night, the main target, in fact, the overwhelmingly most important target, was Ukraine's capital, the city of Kiev. And as well as these missiles, hundreds of drones were also used. Again, this time it appears that many of the drones did indeed attack targets outside Kiev in various parts of Ukraine. The city of Sumy was particularly badly hit, but several hundred drones at least attacked Kiev as well, in conjunction with the missile strikes. And if we're talking about the types of missiles used, well, again, it's all very sketchy. And I noticed that the Russian Defense Ministry, in its own account of the strike, which is, as always, by the way, extremely vague, says virtually nothing about the type of missiles used. It doesn't mention, for example, whether any hypersonic missiles were used. But from what I can understand, many different missiles were used. KH-101, subsonic cruise missiles launched from the sky by Russian strategic bombers. Kalibr subsonic missiles, cruise missiles launched from ships of Russia's Black Sea Fleet, and perhaps also from the Caspian Sea. Ballistic missiles of various types. The Ukrainians always seem to say that these are adapted surface-to-air missiles, S-300s or S-400s. But as far as I can tell, they are almost entirely either Iskander missiles produced in Russia or perhaps occasionally North Korean missiles, which, according to some reports, the Russians have adapted and improved. They've improved their guidance systems to increase their accuracy. And according to quite a few reports, the Russians also launched more Tsirkon hypersonic cruise missiles. Apparently, these were surface launched, in other words, ground launched from ground launchers, some of them located on Russian, on pre-2014 Russian territory, just saying. And there are also some reports that other types of weapons too were launched. KH-69 subsonic stealth missiles launched from Sukhoi 34 or perhaps Sukhoi 57. Fighter jets. And also, interestingly and rather tantalizingly, there's reports of another weapon system also used, perhaps for the first time, which the Russians apparently call the banderol, which is a kind of hybrid jet-powered but rather fast drone, and allegedly a certain number of these were used in the strike as well. Apparently, this is either the first use of this system or at least an early use of this system. So, an enormous strike using a very interesting menagerie of different missiles and drones. And some of the reports that I've seen are saying that all of the Geran drones that struck Kiev were jet-powered, making them perhaps more difficult for the Ukrainian air defences to intercept, and that the Geran drones were benefiting in the attack from signals provided by the relay stations located on the territory of Belarus, the same relay stations that Zelensky demanded Lukashenko close down, which Lukashenko said, well, which Zelensky said Lukashenko did close down, but which General Syrsky, the Ukrainian army chief, as I discussed in my program yesterday, says have not in fact been closed down. If, of course, these drones, these jet-powered Geran drones, were indeed receiving signals from the relay stations in Belarus, then that obviously confirms that, contrary to Zelensky's claims, the relay stations have not been closed down. Now, one weapon system was not, however, used in the strike last night, and that was the Oreshnik. There are no reports that the Oreshnik was used either in the attack on Kiev or anywhere in Ukraine. So expectations from some that the Oreshnik would be used have not been realised. A few days ago, reports appeared in the Ukrainian and Russian media that US intelligence had advised Ukraine not only that there would be a mass strike by the Russians, but that a new type of very powerful weapon system would be used over the course of it. And I said that it seemed to me that that suggested use of one of the variants of the Oreshnik system. Unless the Americans were referring to the banderol hybrid missile drone system, which, to be frank, seems to me extremely unlikely, then that intelligence information was wrong. Perhaps the Russians did intend to use the Oreshnik system in this attack, but what decided them against doing so was the fact of this American warning. The Russians might have said to themselves that after this warning, the Ukrainians would close down and evacuate whatever facility the Oreshnik might be tasked with attacking, in which case there would be no point in attacking the facility. It would just be using a valuable system, an expensive system like the Oreshnik, to attack a target that had already lost its value or had lost some of its value. But that, of course, is a pure guess on my part. I don't know. Probably, and more likely, the Russians never intended to use the Oreshnik system in this attack at all. Putin recently told us that the system, the Oreshnik, is still under development. I received what I have absolutely no doubt is reliable information from Russia that production of the Oreshnik system has now been accelerated. Probably there is still an insufficient number of these systems in use with the Russian military, and probably the missile troops who are receiving this system have not yet been fully integrated into the attack profiles necessary to participate in the strike that we have just seen. So probably, most likely, there was never a plan to conduct an attack on Kiev using this Oreshnik system at all. Now, the Ukrainians are providing us with no information as to what targets the Russians did attack. The Russians, by the way, are providing us with very little information about the targets that the Russians attacked, except to say that the attack was in retaliation to Ukrainian attacks, recent Ukrainian drone attacks on Russia's civilian infrastructure. Now, that is the reason the Russians always give for every one of their big strikes. I personally don't take it seriously. All of these strikes, to me, look like they've been very carefully planned, probably weeks in advance. The Russians undoubtedly do attack industrial and infrastructure facilities. And it seems to me that claiming that these are reprisal attacks for Ukrainian attacks on civilian infrastructure within Russia strengthens Russia's legal position in relation to attacks like the one that they've just carried out. Its legal position in that it has a stronger defense for attacking Ukrainian infrastructure, just saying. And anyway, it's probably something that the Russian leadership calculates that the Russian population inside Russia wants to hear, that Russia is hitting back against Ukrainian attacks, Ukrainian and Western attacks on Russia. But my own view is that all of these strikes form absolutely part of a pre-prepared plan for strikes on Kiev. I believe these strikes will steadily build up in intensity over the next few months, that they're very closely coordinated with the situation on the ground, the movements of Russian forces on the ground. And I also believe, as I've said many times, that sooner or later and eventually the Oreshnik indeed will be used to attack the command systems and command positions, including the underground bunkers in Kiev itself, and probably Kharkov and Dnipro as well. So anyway, that's my own view about this attack. But the Russians are saying that part of some of the targets that were attacked included facilities that produce electronic guidance systems for Ukrainian Flamingo cruise missiles. The Ukrainians have used the Flamingo in various attacks on Russia over the last couple of days. There have been particular attempts by the Ukrainians to strike at a big industrial factory in the city of Volgograd, the former Stalingrad. This industrial facility, to say clearly, is one that is very much part of the Russian defense industry, which makes gun barrels and artillery for the Russian military. So it's an important facility. But I doubt myself that any very long-term damage to this huge, sprawling industrial plant has been done. And I suspect that to the extent that there are gaps in the air defense coverage for Volgograd, they will be filled very soon. Or perhaps they already have been. Anyway, this was a big strike on Kiev, and significant damage has clearly been done. The Ukrainians, of course, as they always do, claim that they shot down practically everything. I think most people who've taken film, who've seen the film and the pictures from Kiev, believe otherwise. Unfortunately and tragically, 13 people were killed over the course of this strike, which is a very, very high number, by the way, for strikes of this kind. And to repeat again, I expect that more strikes like this will come, and I suspect that they are going to be part of a Russian campaign focusing on Kiev that is going to intensify over the course of the next few months in conjunction with the ongoing military campaign that the Russians are conducting in eastern Ukraine, and a military campaign, a strike campaign against Kiev, over the course of which, as I said already, I expect that before long, the Oreshnik system itself is going to be used. Now, here I want to make a fairly general point. Why is Kiev coming under attack like this? Well, to many, that may seem like an obvious question. Kiev is Ukraine's capital. The political leadership is located there. Zelensky is there. Western officials are, of course, there. Western embassies are there. Command centres are there. All of those things. And I have already pointed out in earlier programmes I made about a month ago, that one purpose that the Russians may have, and probably do have, is to get Western embassies to leave Kiev and to get the West to pull its people out of Kiev in the anticipation that Zelensky himself and the Ukrainian leadership will feel politically obliged to remain, which would, of course, sever the direct connection between Zelensky and his Western backers, and which would, to some extent, isolate Zelensky and the Ukrainian leadership from the West. So that is one purpose, or one set of purposes. But there is a further thing, which, of course, no one, I notice, is saying, though in light of what we have been hearing from Zelensky and Syrsky recently about a potential imminent Russian attack on Kiev, I would have thought was an obvious one, which is that if you are the Russians and you are indeed intending at some point in the next few weeks, months, or perhaps year, to attack Kiev itself, to storm Kiev itself, then what you need to do is to soften its defences. And there's been many reports, by the way, that the Ukrainians have recently been busy constructing defences around many of their major cities, Kiev, Odessa, Volyn, others, but certainly Kiev, and also to disrupt the planning and command systems in Kiev, which might organise the defence of the city. And Well, to me at least, this operation, these attacks on Kiev, which, as I said, I now anticipate are going to intensify, especially after the Oreshnik begins to be used, do seem to me to be consistent, let's say this, consistent with a Russian softening up operation ahead of a potential Russian operation to capture Kiev itself. Now, here we come back to what Zelensky has been saying. Zelensky has been talking about a potential threat to Kiev from Belarus. Up to now, there is little evidence of this, and the Ukrainian military, including General Sirski, are saying for the moment that they don't see any direct threat to Kiev from Belarus. But General Sirski, as I discussed in my program yesterday, is saying that the Russians do indeed have a plan. In fact, they have received an order to capture Kiev, but that the attack on Kiev is going to come from the east with a Russian advance from Bryansk region into Chernigov region in northeastern Ukraine. I pointed out in my program yesterday that too many people, it seems to me, are in a hurry to discount this possibility. But I'd already received some weeks ago a tip off from an extremely reliable source that a Russian advance into Chernigov from Bryansk region is indeed in the course of preparation. And for the record, last night that source contacted me again and reminded me that in May, and I'm not going to say which day in May, he did indeed give me this tip off. And the source told me that he stands by the tip off. In other words, he believes that an advance, an attack on Kiev via Chernigov, via northeastern Ukraine, is indeed coming. And well, in several programs recently, extending back now for several weeks, I pointed out that Russian activity around the city of Sumy, which continues, and which has continued over the course of the last few hours, by the way, seems increasingly consistent with a plan to capture the city of Sumy. Putin himself, when he recently discussed the situation relative to the city of Sumy, in his recent interview with the journalist Pavel Zarubin, said that the Russians have no political interest in the city of Sumy, but he appeared to leave it to the military to decide whether the city of Sumy should be stormed or captured or not. Which suggests to me that he has, at the very least, given the military the green light to do it. And as I have pointed out also, capturing the city of Sumy would be fully consistent with an intended operation against Kiev itself. Sumy is on the main road to Kiev. And I believe that road, for the record, runs through Chernigov region, though I haven't actually studied the map, so I might be wrong on that. Anyway, I'm just saying all of these things. Putin's press spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, has said that the commander of the Russian forces in the area of the special military operation, General Gerasimov, who also is the chief of the general staff of the Russian armed forces, briefed Putin yesterday about the strike on Kiev. And when I say actually correct that, briefed Putin this morning about the strike on Kiev. And Peskov, perhaps inadvertently, leaked the fact or disclosed the fact that apparently Gerasimov and Putin meet every Thursday, whether in person or virtually, with Putin receiving a detailed briefing from Gerasimov about what is actually going on in the area of the special military operation. So anyway, again, a fair amount of speculation on my part. But to repeat again, these repeated, increasingly powerful attacks on Kiev no doubt serve various objectives, but one of them looks to me increasingly like softening up Kiev itself in preparation for a Russian operation to capture Kiev. The Ukrainians, Syrsky and Zelensky, are now increasingly talking about such an operation. And the private information I've received from a source about a planned Russian offensive into Chernigov region is fully consistent with such an operation, as are the recent Russian moves in and around the city of Sumy. Anyway, that's what I wanted to say about all of this. As I said, you can all of you decide what you think about these things. As I said, I want to repeat again, there's a lot of speculation on my part. Reading the runes in this war is not always easy. And to repeat again, Putin and Gerasimov and the Russian general staff and Belousov do not share much or indeed any of their plans with me. So, you know, I can speculate, but I can't pretend that I actually know. Anyway, in the meantime, the war continues and lots of things continue to happen in the war. We've had now lots of pictures from Kupiansk, the area of Kupiansk, both the east bank of the Oskol River, the area of Kupiansk, which is on the east bank of the Oskol River, and the villages to the south of Kupiansk, and Kupiansk on the west bank of the Oskol River, where most of the residential city of Kupiansk is located. There's an awful lot of talk and discussion about Kupiansk, and there has been for some time now. Putin, over the course of his interview with Pavel Zarubin, said that the Russian military is now located 4.5 kilometers to the west of the city of Kupiansk. Some people still find that difficult to accept. There continue to be claims that the Ukrainians retain a presence in some parts of the city of Kupiansk. There's been now multiple pictures of Russian troops in the city of Kupiansk, both on the east and the west bank of the Oskol River. I have seen nothing that would lead me to doubt what Putin is saying. If, as I believe, Kupiansk has indeed fallen, then, in theory at least, the Russians are well positioned to advance to the northwest until they reach a body of water, which I believe is a major reservoir. And Russian forces appear to be moving to the same towards the same body of water from Volchansk in the north. And the distance now between these advanced, these two converging Russian forces is no longer that great. The Russians seem to be increasingly tightening their grip around the small town of Belykolodyaz in northeastern Kharkiv region. It seems to me that there is now a clear Russian plan to bring the whole of northeast Kharkiv region between Kupiansk and Volchansk and up to the eastern shore of this reservoir fully under Russian control. And that will be a very significant part of Kharkiv region. And it would also incidentally position the Russians very close to the city of Kharkiv. Indeed, I believe that the Russians controlled all of this territory before Ukraine's successful Kharkiv offensive in the autumn of 2022. Once Kupiansk was recaptured by the Ukrainians in the autumn of 2022, the Russians withdrew from all of this territory. There wasn't any actual fighting there. Now, obviously, there is, but it looks as if before long, the Russians will recapture it. And with Kupiansk under control and Liman essentially under control, if the Russians choose to advance across the Oskol River and recapture Izium and Balaklaya, well, I won't say that nothing stands in their way. The Oskol stands in their way. But at least they can do it. It's an operation now that is increasingly coming within their reach. And if this does happen, and if the Russians do advance into Chernigov region from Bryansk region, then, to say it straightforwardly, all of the territory that Ukraine brought back under its control in the second half of 2022 in northeastern Ukraine will have come back under Russian control again. But of course, in a very different way, because back in 2022, as we now know, Russian forces were relatively few in number, and they had not experienced the experience, they did not have the experience of war that they do today. And today, of course, they are in far greater number. If the Russians recover all of this territory, then it's all but impossible to imagine that the Ukrainians can ever recapture it by force of arms. And the city of Kharkiv itself, already under pressure from heavy Russian bombing and with the filling stations along the supply roads also leading to Kharkiv, also being systematically attacked and destroyed by the Russians. All the city of Kharkiv itself will look extremely isolated and, well, in a far more vulnerable position than it did at any point in 2022. Just saying. And of course, in Donbass itself, the pressure on the Ukrainians continues to be relentless. Now, about 2 days ago, I discussed reports about a Russian advance that was supposed to have happened right up to the outskirts of the town of Dobropilia, which lies to the west of the Slavyansk-Kramatorsk conurbation. I said that these reports were coming from Russian sources, but had not been confirmed by the Russian military itself. And there is no video footage that confirms these reports. And I did wonder whether these reports could possibly be true. I still am not sure. But there is now clear proof that the Russians are indeed advancing towards Dobropilia. Maybe not from the west, not from the east rather, but certainly from the south, that the Russians are pushing forward northwards towards Dobropilia from Pokrovsk and Mirnograd. There reports this morning that an important village on the way to Dobropilia, the village of Shevchenko, is either under attack or has been captured by the Russians. Again, I am not there. I don't know. But if this village is indeed captured, and especially if those reports about a Russian advance on Dobropilia from the east are true, then we would indeed be looking at a significant operational crisis for the Ukrainians. But anyway, let's not perhaps leap too far ahead, and let's not jump into the world of conjecture, given that these Russian advances towards Dobropilia have not really been confirmed up to now. The Russian Defense Ministry continues to report clearing operations in Liman and Konstantinovka. There was a report on the Russian military's Telegram channel that for the moment, the Russians are clearing basements in Liman, where they believe Ukrainian soldiers may be hiding. There was another report, also from the Russian military, that the Russians have now fully cleared and secured eastern Konstantinovka. And lastly, there's been video footage provided by the Russians, which appears to discredit claims that the Ukrainians conducted some kind of counterattack to the north of Liman, presumably in an effort to slow the Russian capture of Liman. So, putting all of this together, the pressure on Slavyansk and Kramatorsk continues to increase. Putin recently said that there is street fighting taking place in the village of Nikolaevka to the east of Kramatorsk. Again, what we know tends to support that claim, even if it doesn't fully prove it. But what we are seeing and what we are hearing from all of these reports and rumours, they do all tell ultimately the same story, that the Russians are pressing on Slavyansk and Kramatorsk, which, as Marat Khairulin, the Russian journalist, said, are on low ground at the base of a river valley, where the Russians now control all the high ground, that the Russians are pressing on Slavyansk and Kramatorsk. They're pressing on Kramatorsk from the east. They have folded the flanks of this defence line by essentially capturing Liman and Konstantinovka. And what all of these reports about Dobropilia also suggest is that the Russians are aiming to capture Ukrainian positions to the west of Slavyansk and Kramatorsk, and to create a cauldron for the Ukrainian troops who are garrisoned and trying to defend these cities. Again, in a program I did a few days ago, I discussed the theory of Scott of Calibrated that the Ukrainians will eventually retreat from Slavyansk and Kramatorsk, that they recognize that these two cities are becoming undefendable. Well, I have my doubts about that, but what I will say about that in this program, which is that if the Ukrainians want to avoid trapping a significant number of their troops in a cauldron in Slavyansk and Kramatorsk, that is exactly what they should do. And the time to do it is now. Delaying much further would, I think, be extremely risky and very dangerous and would certainly be a mistake. And lastly, since I'm now doing a rundown of the situation on the front lines, apparently more settlements have been captured in eastern Zaporozhye. The Russians presumably will want to attack the village of Pokrovskaya, or rather the small town of Pokrovskaya, fairly soon. The Russians appear to be very close now to the main supply road to Orekhov from the north. I doubt that much traffic can move down this road anymore. I would have thought that Russian drones and light artillery, mortars and rockets and anti-tank missiles can definitely hit targets, hit cars or trucks moving along this road from the positions the Russians already have. Anyway, I doubt that this road is in much use in terms of supplying Orekhov anymore. But there are other roads further west which the Ukrainians can use to continue to supply Orekhov. And for the moment, as far as I can tell, supplies are still reaching Orekhov along these roads. But again, I saw a map provided by one of the mapping projects, I forget which one, and you can see that General Teplinsky's forces also appear to be closing in on Orekhov from the west, and they're getting dangerously close to these more western supply roads. And, well, on this map, the advanced vanguard of the Russian forces closing on Orekhov from the east, the northeast, and Teplinsky's forces advancing on Orekhov from the southwest, that these two Russian forces are now getting closer and closer. And it seems to me that the pincers around Orekhov itself are now gradually closing. Again, just as it would probably be wise for the Ukrainians to pull their troops out of Slavyansk and Kramatorsk sooner rather than later to avoid a cauldron there, the same equally applies to Orekhov, trying to hold out in Orekhov to try to defend Orekhov would be a huge mistake. It would repeat the mistakes that the Ukrainians made perhaps most spectacularly in Ugledar in 2024, when the Ukrainians refused to retreat, to allow the brigade that was defending Ugladar to retreat from Ugladar until it was far too late, with the result that that brigade, one of the best brigades in the Ukrainian army, was in effect destroyed. Now, these are the movements on the front lines. Now, many people always come back and say, well, these are small incremental movements. I'm not sure that they are actually that small any longer or that incremental. But I make no apology for talking about them. One of the things I have long since learned, both about war and about pretty much everything else, business, law, science, engineering, these sort of things, is that if you really want to understand what is actually going on in any given situation, you have to get deep into the weeds. You have to get that sense of the granular detail of what is actually happening. That it is a major mistake to say to yourself, I can distance myself from it and look at the bigger picture, and because things aren't happening quite as fast as I imagine they should, that means whatever I think it means. I've seen this happen many times. I've seen this happen, especially in business, I should say. But I've also seen it happen in law. When people take that approach, they very quickly lose contact with reality. They always end up thinking that things are better than they really are. The devil is in the detail in all things, and most certainly it is there in military developments as well. Perhaps a place like Dobropilia is not one that most people have heard of and have no reason to have heard of, but it is important in this war, and its loss by Ukraine will further shape the outcome. Anyway, that's what I want to say about the military situation in the war. I noticed in the meantime that the Ukrainians, Zelensky is now once again talking about holding some kind of elections in Ukraine in the autumn. I don't believe that for one millisecond. I don't believe that he has any intention of holding elections. He's had ample opportunities to hold elections if he wanted to, ever since May 2024, when he extended his term. I don't believe Zelensky really intends to hold elections. But I think he's now talking about elections again because he wants to convey this impression that the situation in Ukraine is more stable than it really is. So that's one thing. But I also, that even as Zelensky is projecting an attitude of confidence, of sublime certainty that things are going well for him and for Ukraine, his officials are now coming back and are asking the European Union for another disbursement of 6.6 billion euros. This sum coming not from the 90 billion euro loan, but from entirely separate funds that Zelensky apparently now wants to tap. I always said that the 90 billion euro loan would never cover Ukraine's financial needs for the two-year period that the European government said it would when they approved the loan back in December last year. I said that I thought that by midsummer, the Ukrainians would come back for more. Well, it appears to me that that is exactly what is happening. Meanwhile, even as the Ukrainians come back asking for more money, the Europeans seem perfectly happy to go on giving them money. And they do this despite the economic and fiscal crisis that we see across Europe at the present time. That crisis has been thrown into stark relief by the £15 billion announcement by the British Prime Minister, the outgoing British Prime Minister, Keir Starmer. £15 billion additional, £15 additional billion to be spent on the British military over the next 4 years. Now, virtually everybody, right across the journalistic commentariat and the political class, has complained that this is nowhere near enough, that the situation of the British military is grave, that if there really is indeed a threat from Russia, then the extra £15 billion that Keir Starmer is coming up with over the next 4 years is not going to be anywhere near to fill the gap. The only commentator in mainstream media or in what you might call the main political class, the mainstream political class, who's come forward and said we should not be spending £15 billion on defence. There is no threat to Britain. The threat to Britain from Russia is a figment of people's imagination. The only reporter I have seen with the courage to say that is Simon Jenkins in The Guardian. And let's give Simon Jenkins credit. Once again, he has shown himself to be one of the few level-headed and courageous journalists writing in mainstream media in Britain that we have left here. All of the others are coming forward and are saying that this £15 billion is not enough. And my very good friend, Ian Proud, the former British diplomat, has come forward and has actually unscrambled the figures. And he says that in some respects, this criticism is absolutely true. It's perfectly correct. If you look at the amounts that Keir Starmer is proposing, not only are they insufficient to make up the gaps in the British military that people are so concerned about, in fact, and in reality, those gaps are going to get worse. The British Army, the British Navy, the Royal Air Force, they are actually going to see less funding than they have previously. This announcement is a cut in funding for these services, not an increase. And if you go to his article on his Substack site, The Peacemonger, and you go to his video, the video that he's published on his excellent YouTube channel, you will see that he lays it all very clearly. He lays it all out. The point is that in order to find this extra £15 billion, most of which, as Ian Proud is correctly says, is going to go to beef up Britain's inordinately expensive and entirely useless nuclear forces, useless because Britain can't use them without the agreement of the Americans, which really begs the question and makes one wonder about the whole point. Anyway, in order to find this extra £15 billion, Starmer has had to cut spending, and he's cut spending on road refurbishment and apparently in some form on the energy system. Now, anybody who lives in Britain knows how poor the state of many of our roads has become, and also knows how expensive energy costs have become too. In fact, I believe I am right in saying that Britain has the highest energy costs in the G20. But what can Starmer do? He has to make the problems with the roads and the energy system even worse in order to find this extra money for defence, which is not going to achieve, practically speaking, anything. Those who demand much more for defence, I notice, are never very clear about what part of Britain's spending they intend to cut in order to make this additional defence spending possible. Do they intend to reduce Social Security, for example? If so, on whom? For whom? For which people who receive Social Security? Working adults with disabilities? Pensioners? Who exactly? I've seen many people talk about cutting back spending on immigrant communities. Well, anybody who has unscrambled the numbers knows that that's going to come to nowhere near enough if all of these spending totals that people are talking about are ever going to be found. So what exactly are people suggesting should be cut? Or are they saying the taxes should be increased instead? A risky idea, given that most people in Britain feel that they are paying significantly too much in taxes. So anyway, this announcement by Starmer, what it does is it highlights a truth that is true not just in Britain, but everywhere in Europe. Demands to increase defence spending, which outside Germany, which still has some fiscal space because of Germany's still relatively good debt and fiscal position. Elsewhere in Europe, these costs simply cannot be met. Well, there it is. We are in denial about this. We are frightening ourselves with a Russian threat, which, like Simon Jenkins, I firmly believe does not exist. And we are proposing to spend money on defence, money that we do not have, to buy weapons which we cannot make. None of this makes any sort of sense to me. Nor, of course, does our energy policy. I discussed in a recent programme the very bad situation with natural gas reserves in Europe, the fact that they are at dangerously low levels ahead of the summer and the winter, and that there is at least a possibility that we're going to see prices for natural gas rise in the autumn, as we saw in the autumn of 2021, and perhaps even shortages of natural gas and blackouts in Europe over the course of the winter, as we just managed to avoid in the winter of 2021-2022. And of course, largely, that is a product of recent policy decisions, the decision to stop importing natural gas by pipeline from Russia, the fact that since the crisis began in the Persian Gulf, easy supplies of natural gas from Qatar have basically ended. Norway and Algeria cannot supply natural gas in the quantities and perhaps at the price that Europe properly needs. And that has thrown us into increasing dependence on the United States, which now supplies a very, very large proportion of Europe's natural gas. So we have gone from a claimed dependency on the Russians for natural gas, which never existed, into an actual dependency on the United States. Now, I say actual dependency because I can never remember a single instance when the Russians insisted on changes in European Union policy in return for continued Russian supplies of natural gas, all the way up to the start of the special military operation in February 2022, right up to the moment when the European Union began to impose massive sanctions on Russia, including freezing Russia's central bank's assets. And even beyond that, the Russians never imposed any formal decisions on the export of natural gas to Europe. Indeed, yesterday, Russia's foreign ministry spokesman actually said and made the correct point that even now, Russia has not imposed any formal restrictions and prohibition on its industry, preventing it from exporting natural gas. It would have to be liquefied natural gas, mostly now, to Europe. But the United States, it turns out, is different, because the President of the United States, Donald Trump, is not happy about certain decisions that the European Union says it wants to make in connection with methane emissions. And he's actually said that unless the European Union rolls back those policy decisions in relation to methane, well, in that, unless they do that, the United States will stop supplying natural gas to Europe, liquefied natural gas to Europe. Now, I don't know whether Donald Trump really means that. I don't know whether such a thing can even happen. I don't know whether Donald Trump is in a position to stop American companies involved in the export of natural gas, from stopping their exports of liquefied natural gas to Europe for a reason like that. But he's talked about it. I don't remember a single moment, any occasion, when Vladimir Putin or any Russian official made that kind of threat or that kind of demand of Europe. So, given that, were the Americans ever to act on the threat that President Trump has made, it would indeed be an absolutely critical disaster for Europe. You would have thought that actually diversifying imports of energy, importing energy from Russia, for example, might actually be a wise thing for the Europeans to do. But no, of course not. We must never, ever buy natural gas from a country that has historically been a cheap and reliable supplier and which has never made any threat of that kind against Europe or against the European Union. We must instead import much more expensive liquefied natural gas from a country whose president shows no inhibitions about making threats of that kind. Anyway, I don't want to dwell on this too much and too long. Every one of you knows about these things. Everyone knows that these strange decisions are made. I wonder for how much longer these strange and illogical decisions can be sustained. Not very much longer, I am going to guess. In my opinion, we're going to start to see, as I said already in recent programs, major developments on the Ukrainian battlefronts over the next few weeks and months, with events leading to the fall of Donbass, to the fall of Zaporozhye, perhaps events leading to the return of the Russians to Kiev as well. And, well, at that point, I suspect this strange logic that we have been living under is going to come under challenge. Certainly, I do believe one thing. In Germany, they are now increasingly talking about reintroducing conscription, given that young Germans show no desire to enlist in the German army in order to fight the Russians. I recently said that something like 200,000 questionnaires were sent out to young people across Germany, apparently with the intention of getting at least some of them to enlist, but only 500 came forward and said that they were interested in doing so. Now, what I would say about that is that if the German government, if the German leadership really does want to radicalize Germany's youth, to perhaps trigger the emergence of a genuine peace movement in Germany, then reintroducing conscription in conditions when there is this rhetoric about war with Russia is perhaps the most straightforward way to go about doing it. But anyway, we shall see. In the meantime, the war in Ukraine continues. As to the conflict in the Persian Gulf, well, there's now been word that the Iranians and the Americans are finally going to have direct discussions with each other in Doha. We will see what will come of that. But for the moment, the war in Ukraine grinds on. The Russian offensive, will continue throughout the summer, just as it did in 2024 and 2025. The pace will accelerate. Before long, the towns and the cities will fall. And then in the autumn, in Europe, the panic will begin. This is where I'm going to finish today's programme. Let me remind you again that you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X and Substack. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop, links under this video. Last but not least, please remember if you've liked this video to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.